Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, our friend and Denny's co-host, Susan Murphy Milano, has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her website at www.conqueringcancer.me. Tonight on the agenda is the Lisa Irwin case. My name is Kim Colton. Denny is on vacation, and I'm pleased to have Peter Hyatt as my co-host tonight. And along with Peter, we have Ron Rugen, a private investigator who is very close to the case as well. Peter, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you. And Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Okay, we're all here. So, Peter, would you like to start by telling our listeners the story of what we called the Baby Lisa case?
Sure. And in fact, if I could, maybe I'll start from where I got involved. It's kind of an interesting
story.
I believe it was early October in 2011, I received an email from someone that said something to the effect of, oh no, here we go again, and please look at this video. And what it was the very first time that Deborah Bradley, the mother of baby Lisa, had gone before the television cameras to report her child missing. And as we talked about in past shows, what we do is we have an expectation of truth. We presuppose in our presuppositional thinking that a person is going to tell us the truth, and it is what we expect to hear. And any one of us can just use our imagination on what we would think that a young mother of a missing child would say. When the missing child's mother speaks, and we don't hear what we expected, but we hear the unexpected, that's where we begin to run into trouble. And one of my blog's readers had quickly picked this up, and she had just done an excellent job with it, was that the mother did not speak for herself very much. She spoke using the word we, and this was unexpected, because a missing child to a mother will trigger the protective capacities and instincts like nothing else in this world can. And that's why we hear about things like be careful of a mother bear robbed of her whelps. There's no satisfying her anger, that sort of thing. It's just an instinctive part of nature that we all know. And when Deborah Bradley spoke, and this was just for a very few minutes, to report her child missing, her child been kidnapped, I didn't even hear the story at that point. I was just looking at the pronouns going, oh my, she won't use the pronoun I. She won't take ownership of this, and a missing baby is very personal. So I knew we had a problem on our hands. I mean, I knew this was going to be another probably very bad case. And so what she reported was that basically a stranger had got into her home while she was sleeping, turned on the lights, got in through a window, found the exact place where the baby was, and was able to get out, again, with the baby, without waking anyone or dogs or neighbors or anyone else, picking just the right night, the right window. And, in fact, the night that the husband wouldn't be home as well. And they quickly cleared him, saying he had an alibi. So just the circumstances of it were kind of strange as it was. But it's the language that I focus in on. Then Deborah Bradley spoke again, and she spoke at more length. And I heard the unexpected. She referenced her child in the past tense, which is a verbal indication that the child is dead. A mother, a guilty mother, for instance, will reference her child in the present tense as she's reporting her missing, but then slip up while she's speaking. Some people call it by the seat of your pants, we call it the free editing process, to speaking on her own extemporaneously in thinking about the child, will speak of her in the past tense. It's an indication that she knows or believes the child is dead. So the first thing we asked there is, have police said anything to her to indicate the child is dead? Because the maternal instinct of denial is so powerful that even when a mother knows the child is dead, she still has a difficult time accepting that. If a mother can accept the child is dead, oftentimes it's an indication that the mother has guilty knowledge and that the denial is part of a way of protecting herself. So in early to mid-October, I think it was around October 6 or 7 or so, we were introduced to Deborah Bradley through television and through video, and we were able to discern very quickly that she was being deceptive in her answers.
And Deborah, of course, is the mother, and
yes.
Jeremy is the father. Okay.
The story gets even more interesting from that point, where Jeremy Irwin, who was not home, eventually, as he went on, he was deceptive also. And what it showed was he had likely had a reason to stop cooperating with police at a certain point. One of the interesting things that he said was he was asked, who would do such a thing? And he said, maybe someone that cheated on her husband. Where did that come from? So he introduced the topic of infidelity to us, which was quite strange. But there was another thing, was when he spoke out, he wasn't very convincing that someone had the child. He spoke out and said, if someone has her, you can drop her off such and such a place. And if he had been reporting that his wife would tell the truth and someone had kidnapped her, why would he say, if someone has her? So as time went on, we saw that he was also deceptive, not to the same level Deborah was. He seemed more deceptive in that, I believe, Deborah Bradley broke the news to him that the child did indeed die and it wasn't her fault and that she panicked and sought out help in getting rid of the child. He was clearly protecting his wife. He refused to be interviewed alone without her presence by the police. And then we had a statement from Joe Tacopina, which really was interesting to me. He said that parents are fully cooperating. And if the parents were fully cooperating, he probably wouldn't tell us that. He probably would say the parents are cooperating. But the fact that he had need to emphasize fully, we learned that they did give permission to search the house, but not all of it, just parts of the house. And part of the house that wasn't allowed to be searched, we know there was a cadaver dog hit for the smell of decomposition. So it's one of these cases where I think something happened that night, whether it was an abdication of neglect where a baby was dropped, or it was a flash of anger where the baby was shaken. Something happened that night while Jeremy was at work that Deborah Bradley did and was involved in that caused the death of Lisa, and then Deborah went into a really strange cover-up mode.
Well, how old, Peter, let me just interject here. How old was Lisa again? Was she two?
I don't think she was quite two. I thought she was still a toddler.
So,
10 months.
Pardon me, Ron?
10 months.
10 months. Oh, my goodness. Now, wasn't it also reported that Bradley had been drinking heavily that night with others in her home? Now, was that discounted, or was came home from work?
Yeah, no, I'd actually like to discount that somewhat. What had happened was Deborah Bradley was speaking a lot, and she was getting contradictory statements. Her story was changing. She gave different accounts of where she was, about the cell phones, and what time she saw Lisa. And suddenly, we find out, I think it was on a Sunday, if I remember correctly, and I'll have some questions for Ron in a second about this, but suddenly she showed up on the circuit for interviews and media, and media was able to ask her, hey, were you drinking? Hey, were you drunk? I think Joe Tacopina, his arrival on the case, killed the case. My personal belief is that Deborah Bradley, who had failed a polygraph, was very close to giving an admission of what had happened. My sources tell me that she was close to the breaking point and the police were about to have a conclusion in this case when Tacopina showed up and shut everyone down. Deborah Bradley never said that she was drunk. And the audience that knows statement analysis understands what I mean when I say that. Deborah Bradley never said the words, I was drunk. She said, she was asked, were you drinking? She said, yes. And she was coy about it. And did you drink enough to be drunk? Mm-hmm. She couldn't bring herself to say the words, and she couldn't use the pronoun I. She never once took ownership of it herself. She entered into someone else's language. And so I think that, yeah, she was drinking, but she did not black out. I'll tell you why that is in a moment. And I think that Joe Tacopina very cleverly, this was right out of the page of Joseph Goebbels. He is a propaganda master, and he's good at it, and he's forceful in his language. He had media ask that question, and this was able to cover up for her conflicting stories. Then on Jane Velez Mitchell, when they discussed the case, they asked one of the fellow they call the crime analyst, could this have been the reason why she failed the polygraph? And he said, yeah, sure, absolutely not. In order to fail, if alcohol blackouts are not recoverable from what we know now, including any type of medical intervention. If there's a true alcohol blackout, the memory is gone. If you don't remember something, you can't fail a polygraph about it. There's nothing for you to reach into to lie. When someone is deceptive, the only way that I can tell that someone is deceptive is if their will is involved. So if I say to you XYZ, and then you tell Ron, Peter said XYZ, and XYZ is a lie, Ron can say, hey, XYZ, and his language won't show that he's lying because he doesn't know he's lying. In order to be seen as deceptive, there has to be a physiological change, and there has to be a will. You have to have a need to fool others or trick others. So passing out and not remember anything, her memory is going to be blank. And so when she asks the question, the questions aren't going to trigger much of a reaction because she doesn't have a memory of it. That was a lie. And that was a really foolish reporting on that show, by the way. So the interesting thing about the case now is that, and introducing Ron to the audience, most of the audience knows him, he is a private investigator with a journalistic background. To me, it's the best of both worlds there in terms of getting information. And he got involved in the case, and I think I'll let you speak for yourself, Ron, but I think that you began, started out with believing that she was kidnapped, and then that kind of changed over time. Maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. I got. I kind of fell into the case by accident. I was driving home. I live 7 miles one direction away from the crime scene, and my office is in downtown Kansas City, 7 miles another direction from the crime scene. So I was, right nearby. When this first happened on the evening of October 3rd and into the morning of October 4th, I really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. It was another news story, kids missing. Didn't pay much attention to it. I busy with my own clients, with my own work. And then the next week, I'm coming home from work, and my iPad is lighting up on my way home from serving summonses about 10:30 or 9:30 at night. And I see where some guy named Bill Stanton from New York claims to be a private investigator. And he says that he is here to help the family on the case. I get home. I watch the videos on the internet of the news conference. And this guy, you know, says he's a PI and he's going to help. And I'm thinking, well, I've never heard of this fellow before. You know, I didn't know anything about him. So having been somewhat involved in getting private investigators licensed in the state of Missouri, getting the you know, lobbying for the legislation to occur, we just started getting licensing back in 2010. There's a mandatory provision in the state law of Missouri that says that if a private investigator suspects someone of conducting unlicensed activity, there's a mandatory whistleblower provision. We have a responsibility to turn that person in. So my first reaction was to look on the licensing website, and there was no Bill Stanton license in the state of Missouri. And so I contacted a couple of the media outlets, the TV media, about 11 o'clock that night and shared that with them. And sure enough, 6:30 in the next morning, one of the reporters held up a copy of all the licensed PIs in the state of Missouri. And from my mouth to their ears to the TV, it was on at 6:30 the next morning. On my drive into work that next morning, that same morning, I stopped by the crime scene and visited with that reporter and just shared, you know, a few more details about it so that they had some accurate information on it to kind of, you know, fill in the blanks. And she said, would you mind doing an interview with us? Well, having been a former news reporter and a former press spokesman for the Missouri Director of Social Services, you know, I know what it's like to not only to speak to the media, but I also know what it's like to be told no whenever you want to interview someone. And I never cared much for that when I was a reporter. So I said, yeah, you know, if you think I can add something, I'll be happy to do it. So by the time I left that morning, I had talked to all four Kansas City TV stations, a network reporter off camera, and they asked if I would, you know, share information with them if I got anything else. Well, went back to my office that morning, make a long story short, found out Bill Stanton was not only not licensed in Missouri, I could not confirm he was licensed anywhere. In New York, he allegedly holds a license for being a, quote, security guard unarmed. And so my initial reaction, kind of, you know, in the direction Peter's taking this is, you know, if someone's going to lie on national and local television about being licensed in Missouri, then what else are they misleading us about? And maybe I shouldn't use the term lie, but at least it wasn't forthright. So later that day, Stanton held a news conference. All the reporters wanted to talk about was my assertion that he wasn't licensed, and he didn't want to talk about it. So I kind of fell into it that way. A couple weeks later, I started getting access to some of the key players, Megan Wright, the formerly pink-haired girl, who had the cell phone that night that Deborah Bradley's phone allegedly tried to reach. And we did a blog with her, some interviews. It got some attention. And we did some other interviews and kind of straightened out, you know, kind of as Peter highlighted, some of the national shows don't always get things right. And so we started kind of you know, correcting some information that they had out. And so that's kind of how we got involved in the case here. And, you know, we kind of built up a confidence with people who were close to the case because, you know, I was fair with people. I was accurate in my reporting of what they said. So I never had a confidentiality a role in this thing because I wasn't working as a PI. Nobody ever hired me. Nobody's ever retained me. It was more of a reporter blogger, but with the having the PI background, which helped me as well.
Well, Ron, I'm so glad that you did what you did because when I first read the newspaper reports on this wild bill Staten, I thought, okay, he was a cop for 4 years in the 80s, took a very early retirement for a hand injury, became a bouncer, and he wasn't even licensed. You can't get away with that in any state.
Right. And we're the show me state.
Certainly not in your state. Yeah, certainly not in your state. So kudos to you. What did you think when you – now, this pink-haired girl, I hadn't heard about her. Is this something we want to get into, Peter, or should we – I guess maybe
– Well, I think it would be interesting for the audience to hear about Ron's connection with the player.
Yes, yes, I do too.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you talk about Wild Bill Stanton – and I've never had any direct contact with him at the outset of this. Peter's correct. At the outset of this, I was willing to give the family the benefit of the doubt and listen to their side of the story. I had my own, and I'm going to tell you some things tonight that I probably have never shared, but it's been a year now, and doggone it, this thing needs to be taken care of. But I had my own deep throat at about the end of October on this thing. You know, I had someone sharing information with me that I otherwise would not have known and sharing some things that I would not have seen. The whole time that I'm getting information, I'm being very careful as to not to say anything publicly that's going to hinder anything with the police investigation or the FBI investigation. But perhaps my goal during this whole process was maybe I can share something that I can find out that's going to enhance what's out there. And somebody may say, oh, yeah, you know, I saw something that reminds me of that, and maybe I can, you know, add to it. But going back to the thing with Bill Stanton again, my first close interaction with Stanton was whenever I met Deborah Bradley. I believe, I don't have my notes in front of me, but I believe it was December 13th. It was about the second week of December. I was driving down their street on a Saturday afternoon after being out working, and happened to see her and her neighbor, James, oh my gosh, my memory's fading me right now. Anyway, the next door neighbor. And so anyway, I drove back around the corner and I thought, wow, did I just miss an opportunity to perhaps get a chance to talk to them? But at the same time, I was very respectful of their space and didn't want to, you know, be inappropriate or anything, you know. So I drove very slowly down a side street and thought, okay, well, I'm going to give them an opportunity to reach out to me if they want to. So I drove back down the street again, and I slowed, and I waved at them, and they waved back, and I stopped, and I said, Deborah, I've got the phone records. I've been allowed to see the phone records of Megan Wright. Would you like to know what's on them? And she said, yeah, I'd love to. And I said, do you mind if I pull my car over here and we can talk? And she said, no, that's fine. I did not want to be accused of trespassing, so I wanted permission to be on her property because this thing was very sensitive and touchy. So I pulled my car over to the side of the street, walked up the driveway, and met her and the next door neighbor. And they knew immediately. My first thing out of my mouth to them was, do you know who I am? And Deborah Bradley said, yeah, you're Ron Rugen. And it kind of floored me. It blew me away that she knew who I was. I guess I wasn't really aware of what impact that my blogs had already had on this case. And so we visited for nearly 50 minutes. It was a cool day in December, and I met her youngest son who came outside. It was a very cordial visit. I told her I'd pray for her. I never really asked her anything about the case other than we just kind of fell into the conversation of, you know, did your boys, you know, it's been reported that your boys heard something, you know, did they really hear anything? And she said, no, they didn't. Well, that contradicted what she'd already said in the media and other things that I'd been told. So as I left, I said, well, I said, if it gets out that you and I had a conversation today, it's not going to come from me. You know, it's anyway, I just wanted her to know that we spoke and I wasn't going to go, blabbing it everywhere that we had. And she said, okay, great. I appreciate that. A couple of days later, kind of rewinding, I had had a texting relationship with someone at Fox News Network, and they had me on the show on one of their midday shows at one point there, too. So, anyway, whenever I left, Deborah at some point contacts Bill Stanton. Bill Stanton reportedly contacts Fox News Network and raised hell with them, and Fox hasn't contacted me ever since. So somehow or another, Stanton holds Fox's better parts in his hand or something. And so that's kind of how I got initially into it. And then I had a relationship with extended members of the family at that point where we talked a little bit on occasion. And again, I was still trying to keep an open mind, but also be true to myself. So on January 7th, I believe it was, I get a call from a family member of theirs, and they want me to come to their house to visit with them and talk about some things that I might take a look at for them. They weren't happy with what Stanton and his quote-unquote team, whoever that was doing, so they were reaching out to me. And, I wasn't retained. I wasn't charging them anything. I spent that day, well, let me rewind. Deborah Bradley came to that house that day after I'd been there a couple hours, knowing full well I was there. Jeremy dropped her off just to see me. And I spent 4 hours with Deborah Bradley that afternoon. She sat on the couch 2 feet away from me. We visited. She came in the door crying about everything people were saying about her on Facebook. And, I was trying to be sympathetic, and I said, you know what? You can't look at that junk on Facebook. It's going to make you crazy. Just don't pay any attention to what they're saying there. And I was trying to, smooth things out for a little bit where she wasn't on a ledge. And it's interesting, both her and the family member said to me separately when they first saw me that day, are you taping us? And I was not. I could have, but I wasn't. And I told them I wasn't. But I thought that was interesting that was their concerns. And so at one point during the conversation, Deborah showed me a tattoo that she got on her arm, her forearm inside, which happened, I think, between Christmas and New Year's, if I'm correct. And it was a tattoo of a remembrance ribbon with the date or year maybe when Lisa had left, with the other part of the ribbon blank for when Lisa would return.
Who does that remind you of?
Bella Vita, interesting.
Sure.
Ron, I wanted to ask you about the taping. When we did a behavioral analysis write-up on the Baby Lisa case, and it's very simple. What we do is we give a +1 score for something appropriate that the parents do, and we give a -1 for something that is inappropriate. So if the parents spoke to media to get the baby's name out, they get a +1. If the parents hinder the investigation, not cooperate, that's a -1. If they fail a polygraph, that's a -1. Just on the based on the parents' behavior. And in this case, the Bradley and Irwin scored off the charts negative. That's how bad it got. My question to you is, what did you think when they asked you if you were taping this?
Well, it kind of took me back because, you know, to that point, you know, they were really, you know, confiding in me. And as far as, I mean, we were actually going to take a secret trip. I call it secret, but, you know, in that it wasn't going to be made public. We were actually going to drive down the street to some things that that some people had shared with me, and going to look at a residence and such. And I had been told that Deborah had been confiding in psychics and had been visiting with Sam and looking at different locations prior to that. So it just kind of brought me awkward. But, Peter, one thing that happened that day that really threw me for a loop, and as someone who, again, formerly worked for the Department of Social Services, as someone who got custody of my own children after being divorced for 6 years and got full custody, and someone who really loves and cares about their kids, she said to me at one point when we were talking about the Facebook comments, she said, "Ron, when this is all over," she said, "we're going to have a big party, and you're invited, and I won't be anymore. You're invited when Lisa comes home, and we're going to have a big party, and we're going to buy a bunch of boxes of wine to celebrate." Now, Peter, if you remember, the box of wine was the thing that supposedly made her so incoherent that she didn't know what happened or when she last looked at her baby that night. I felt, even for a 26-year-old woman, that that was a very weird an inappropriate thing, and it almost made me want to throw up when I heard it.
Yeah, no, it's extreme. If you think about a maternal instinct, even of an immature 26-year-old, someone that's really superficial and someone's really selfish, there is still that instinct that's there. And I got to tell you, how innocent parents behave and how guilty parents behave are polar opposites. The innocent parents, you want to tape this? Get 100 recorders. Do whatever it takes to find my child. The people that have something to hide, they don't want to be taped, and they're all concerned about what people are thinking of me, because one of the marks of a liar is a liar. None of us like to be called liar. None of us like to not be believed. It hurts us. But it drives a narcissistic liar out of her mind. It is a challenge that knows no bound. And in fact, they will, and when I say they, the narcissistic liar, the habitual liar, the pathological liar, the Casey Anthony, the Billie Jean Dunn, others, they will go to the end of the earth to defend themselves and do just about anything, including stabbing themselves in the back in the meanwhile. And to defend themselves, they'll talk and talk and talk and give more information. And so there's certain people that if you prick them, they'll come flying back at you and end up giving out more. And Deborah Bradley fit that very mature, self-centered, self-centered probably the best description of what she was like in her behavior. And this was seen, and body language people chimed in, but it was seen probably evident to most of us, she really loved the attention she was getting. Really enjoyed it. And she had trouble hiding her smirk. With Takapina calling the shots, she was no longer talking to the local media. Local media cried out and said, "Are you not talking to us because we don't pay you?" And she said, no, not at all," she added, parenthesis. And then they said, can you talk? And she called back and said, "No, we are grieving." Now, of course, you can always take the word grieving to mean, you know, I'm grieving over something, but it's generally associated with death, and the word grieving over a missing child, especially in that type of setting, and the past tense references, is really concerning.
Well, you know, so Peter, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, you talked earlier about Joe Takapina being the master of a spin, or I forget the word you used, but essentially that's what you're saying. If you remember on Good Morning America, which Stanton was criticized for being so much close to Good Morning America that they were having exclusives on this. And if you remember, a few days after Halloween, or maybe the morning after Halloween on Good Morning America, there was videotape of the other two boys, one Jeremy's, one Deborah's, by previous relationships, previous marriages. And if you remember, they showed pictures of these boys, videotape of them out trick-or-treating that night. Well, I am told that that trick-or-treating video was staged. It was, if you know, and I know you all don't, but let me explain a little bit. Kansas City, this area of Kansas City where they live, is not a higher-income community. It's probably a low- to mid-income community. This videotape, I'm told, of the Halloween activities of the boys was supposedly staged in the Overland Park, Kansas area, a suburb of Kansas City, which is in Johnson County, Kansas, which is a mid- to high-income neighborhood. So why would you take the boys out of their community trick-or-treating to stage, you know, their activities in another area just to kind of make things really look good? This, you know, anytime you stage any kind of activity like that, that it's not, you know, actual, just really, you know, adds fuel to the fire.
Yeah, he is a master, and I tip my hat to the guy. He's good. He's $700 an hour. He was rehabilitating her reputation. He dolled her up a little bit. And if you look at the video, I'll ask you this. How many mothers of a missing child could, a couple weeks later, not only go trick-or-treating with their kids, but call in the film camera to do it with them? It was a joke. And I think
right.
A lot of people did see through that, and they saw the hands of the spin masters behind them. But interesting enough, as they continue to do this, when the and maybe you can shed light on this, Ron, when it became apparent that this was going nowhere, the case was dead in the water, which I want to ask you about, but Takapina then jumped on the eyewitnesses. The statements that we had from the eyewitnesses showed deception. The one man that he gave a statement, it was not difficult to discern that he was partly fabricating what he saw that night, and that was gone. And then we had the other woman who's was speaking for her husband. He didn't want to take the camera. He's the one that saw her, and she's repeating it, and she's loving the camera. And her words, as we're assuming she entered into her husband's language, they showed unreliability or deception. They were gone. So Takapina then came out with the someone's using their debit card thing, which was really old news to police and investigators by then. He brought to the media, and I think he did this to float it, and no one really grabbed onto it. And this is for him, there's no interest in the case unless there's media interest. That's his hunger.
Exactly.
And so I don't know how, if I'm correct, this is my belief. Police were close to having Bradley admit that something happened, whether she dropped the baby or shook the baby or something happened, and she was close to admitting it and telling us who helped her and dispose of the body and probably in water. And Takapina put a stop to everything. How does she sleep at night, if that's true?
Well, and you know what's interesting, Peter, back in November when Fox News and People Magazine and all the networks, I think CNN may have been there, CBS was not, NBC was, when they were all there that one Saturday in Overland Park to do these taped interviews, when she told Megyn Kelly and Peter Alexander that she had been drinking, and like you say, she was talked into it. She was, if it was surprising to me because Megyn Kelly's an attorney from Fox News, and if she would have been in court, she would have been said that she was leading the witness because you know she had to coerce or coax her into saying that she was drinking that night. And Deborah and I talked about that as well. But, you know, what's interesting was Takapina came on the scene 2 days, I believe it was the Tuesday after that Saturday, that 3 days, that she had done those media interviews. I'm told that Bill Stanton was lying asleep on the couch during part of the time, and then after the interviews were over, he was surfing the channels trying to figure out which channels had him on TV.
I don't think that Bill made any phone call to Fox and got you knocked off the story. I think it was Joe that did that.
Could be.
I'm from New York and know some of the Wild Bill stories, and the Wild Bill stories are really quite dull. Some say that he just He had a bogus injury. He gamed the system for early retirement. He wasn't very well liked as a cop and that sort of thing. I had relatives that were in New York City Police. He was good in front of the camera, and that was the end of it. And so I think he was taking orders from Capena, and that when he spoke about the reward, for instance, and everything that was being set up, there was deception in his words. But when he speaks, he qualifies everything. Everything is shaded. Everything is either or. Everything is kind of, sort of, really.
Mm-hmm.
So he's never truthful anyway, and it almost becomes exhausting listening to him. But I don't think. He's a legend in his own mind.
Own mind?
Yeah, well, he really is.
You know, here's another interesting thing, Peter. You know, you mentioned what Jeremy said about the possibility of someone cheating on someone else. I cannot confirm this, but I'm told that there may be the possibility that Samantha Brando, the next-door neighbor, had been having some sort of relationship with somebody else. I mean, if you recall, the day that Lisa went missing, the next door neighbors had been to counseling, and Samantha got home that night, and she was the one drinking on the stoop, reportedly drinking on the stoop with Deborah. So you don't know if that's what Jeremy was referring to. I also have been told, I haven't seen anything with my own eyes or can confirm it, but I'm told that Samantha Brando, after this, had some sort of a love interest or relationship, whatever you want to call it, with the cousin of Deborah Bradley's from Texas, who had ties to the benefactor who got involved in this whole thing. So it's murky. It's a soap opera. It's a mess. It's just all very crazy. And just to kind of further bring you along in my involvement in this. I was telling you about the conversation I had with her on January 7th. I was probably in good stead with the family and such right until the Dr. Phil interview. I even advised a family member prior to Dr. Phil, just to kind of, be helpful, that when Deborah was out shopping for clothes, that she needed to wear a long sleeve shirt so she wouldn't show that tattoo on the Dr. Phil show. Well, at that point, and I won't get into some of the detail about it, but the family was starting to pull away from me, and there was kind of starting to begin of a rift there. And I was told the Saturday before they went to the taping for Dr. Phil that they were going to be there. And I was told that I was only one of a few people that knew that that was going to happen and not to say anything. And I, at my word, I did not report anything publicly about it. And then I talked to a reporter and got some information together. And the reporter came back and verified that week that, yeah, they were scheduled to be on Dr. Phil. And so actually I broke the story through a verified third party later that week that they were going to be on. Well, I was then on the Jane Velez Mitchell show the night that she had been on Dr. Phil. I think it was February 3rd. And they were on locally here about 3:00 in the afternoon. And I was on the Jane Velez Mitchell show that night. And Jane asked me what I thought of the appearance on Dr. Phil. And as I recall, the first thing I said was, Jane, if you want to find your baby, you go to the Kansas City Police Department and cooperate. You don't go to Dr. Phil.
There you go.
I get an email after the show from an extended, very extended family member, but had inserted herself on Facebook chats and stuff, asking me why I had said that. And said they were upset about it. And I said, well, I was asked my opinion. I gave my opinion. And then I was, the same person said, well, why were you even on the show? And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I guess they thought maybe I had something to contribute, so I accepted their offer and assumed that they knew what they were talking about and accepted their offer to be on the show. And I said, next time, should I get your permission before I'm accepting a news interview offer? And from that point on, we haven't had any kind of relationship at all, because it became increasingly clear to me, particularly after the Dr. Phil show, that there appeared to be deception. And I have come to the conclusion, and through conversations you and I had, and your information is very compelling, that something happened that night, whether it was an accident or something else, but something happened that night that is amiss, and I doubt very seriously whether we will ever see that baby alive again.
It's tough to hear, but I think that many of the listeners have already accepted this fact going back to almost a year ago, because it'll be coming up on a year. I think it was October 6th or so. But a year has gone by. For a baby to be missing, it's very natural for a parent to cry out for the baby. And when a parent doesn't, there's a reason why. There's a reason why we do the things that we do. Those who say there's no book on missing children, there's no book on dealing with these things, that's not true. There is a book on these things, and there's mounds and mounds of studies and records. And then there is the common sense factor, that if you're walking through a supermarket and you have your three-year-old by your hand and you let go of the hand and the three-year-old wanders off, your reaction will be either you will look or you won't look. If you have the ability to say, oh, well, get in the car and drive home, we can conclude something's very, very wrong. Well, the language never misses. We're looking at a case after case of these type matters where an investigator once said to me, from listening to the statements of a mother of a missing child, you know more about the investigation than some investigators know. And that's part of the training, is where we just simply listen and we let them guide us. And that's why I say, you have a natural feel. You say, you know what, it sounds like this was scripted with the alcohol. Whereas I say, we have a rule. If she can't bring herself to tell us that she was drunk, we can't say it for her. She has a reason why she won't bring it out, the same way she had a reason for failing her polygraph. And so her behavior, you know, some people might cry, some people might get nervous laughter, some people might giggle. I don't look at any of those things. I was raised with seven sisters, and tears could come at any moment, and they could be for any reason. We talked about on the program on last week, where in a training class with FBI agents and detectives, investigators of different stripes, they were told that someone would stand up in front of the class and give an account or a story. It had to be either true or it had to be deceptive, but it had to be one or the other. Don't mix it. And the class would then decide in listening whether it was true or not. And a female detective spoke, and by the end of the story, she was crying, and she was visibly moved with real tears. And her tears caused most of them to vote that she was telling the truth. And she wasn't. She was being deceptive. And when they asked her, but why did you cry? And she said, I cried because this was a really sad story I told. It was that touching. And so I don't look at the brow of Deborah Bradley's forehead and make a judgment, or if she rushes to have to starve herself, or she rushes to become a glutton or this or that. I don't look at how someone reacts to those things. What I do is I listen to what they tell me, and I believe them. And if we take just her words and not interpret them, that's the big secret. With Mark McCliff starts off his training class with this. He says, there were two frogs sitting on a log, and one decided to jump off. How many frogs were left? And the answer is, we don't know. We know that one decided to jump off, but we know that many times we decide to do something, we don't follow through. The point of the matter is not just to listen to what has been said, but to know that deceptive people are counting on us to interpret. So I knew that unless Deborah Bradley tells me that she was drunk, that I'm going to have a real hard time believing it. And so she wasn't able to bring herself clearly to say that, so I didn't. So when on the Chamberlain Mitchell show, I was looking at the transcripts tonight, when one of their commentators said, yes, that would cause her to fail a polygraph because she couldn't remember, I thought, well, you know, what planet is that from? How could there be such terrible misinformation going out like that? I like when people have that intuitive sense of a case where they say, why isn't the mother out looking? Why is she going from show to show? How is that helping in any way, shape, or form? Where are the negotiations? This is a great question. Kyron Hormone went missing a couple of years ago, and Desiree Young was the mother, and we looked at Desiree Young early on, and she was quickly cleared because her language was truthful. To have asked her, hey, could you have gone trick-or-treating 3 weeks after Kyron went missing? She could barely function. She was on an adrenaline rush in one sense, that she was up all night thinking about every last possible thing that could have happened, battling depression on the other side, and all the heartache. She's an example or a book, a living book, on how people react. So when people, let's say, Ron, for instance, you were accused of embezzlement, and not only did you not embezzle the money, you weren't even in the building. There is no reason for you to say, I can't comment on this time. On advice of attorney, my attorney, I can't talk about it. What happens is a person that didn't do it will say, I didn't do it, early, often, and depending on the accusation, if it's a disgusting accusation, they will climb to the roof of their house and they will shout it out loud. Innocent parents will continue to shout the child's name everywhere they go, no matter what, no matter who tells them to shut up, no matter whether the police suspect them or not, they don't care. They are so single-minded. And any of us that are parents or grandparents, put yourself in that position. Think if your child was missing, would there be anything I could say to you to shut you up? And I don't think there is. What if police suspect me? Who cares? I know I didn't do it. They're not going to be able to prove anything because I didn't do it. Please help me find my child. John right. Walsh says, take the polygraph. Clear yeah. yourself immediately.
So did Mark Class.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
go ahead, please.
Unfortunately, I think in sometimes with the television cases, I agree with Ron's view of the questioning being leading questions. In some of these television appearances by different experts, they're looking to build a name for themselves. And you can't blame them. They have books they want published, or they want to build their own resumes. But it sometimes comes at the expense of truth. It sometimes comes where they're commenting on things they don't know about, or they're asking heavily compounded questions, which give them more camera time, but allows the subject to pick and choose which they'd like to answer. And so which really is it? Is it about getting information, or is it about having your voice heard?
Well, you know, Peter, so many times on these national shows, I've wanted to correct misinformation that's been out there and, of course, haven't been able to. But, you know, no disrespect intended, but there's a lot of the talking heads that follow so many cases here and there that are the experts on this that it's very difficult to, you know, for them to get out accurate information. Probably the only exception to that, someone who really follows them and really, you know, has things pretty much nailed on is Pat Brown, the criminal profiler. And you know, you can pretty much take to the bank that she, you know, she follows these things. But there are so many of the other talking heads on these shows that say things. And I'm like, you know, that's not entirely accurate, you know, but, you know, you just can't correct it.
No,
I agree.
They throw a shoe at the TV. There was one on last week who was an expert so-and-so. And she said that a mother spoke of her child in the present tense. And I don't know if you know this, Nancy, but when a mother speaks in the present tense, it means the baby's alive. And I thought, oh, my goodness. She perused my blog, didn't stop long enough to read it properly, and now is misusing a tool. No, it's a mother will always speak in the present tense. It's the ones that slip into on the occasion, the past tense. Oh, I know, it was on the missing cousins case. where one of the, some of the family is really acting bizarre, or we have a case where where some of the experts will run to be supportive of the mother, so the mother will come back in the show again, but in doing so, they're almost betraying truth. You know, I can tell just by listening, this mother's a very caring mother, and she just is really out here and is so wrong that she's being picked on by some of the callers. And I think to myself, you're defending a sociopath. You can't have that little discernment and be in the position that you are, where people are listening and thinking that your opinion is worthwhile, when what you're doing is you're praising every criminal that comes on the show. If you watch it for a number of years, you'll see the kind of the pattern that arises. And it's almost, once that starts, it's a rush. That's where Pat Brown gets herself in trouble. Mm-hmm. She likes to speak her mind, mm-hmm. and she's got a good analytical mind, and she's got a good healthy dose of common sense. She gets herself in hot water, and sometimes she sticks out like a sore thumb, because the other talking heads will be praising the character of someone they don't even know. And Pat will say, you know, there's a few things that bothers me here. So I think that's what Ron may have been referencing.
That's true.
Ask you a question, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still able to contact anybody that's close, any of the players in the case?
You mean as far as ask some questions?
Any restrictions put on you? Have the police told you to butt out, or?
I, as much as you and I are friends, I'd respectfully decline to answer that question.
Okay. I think unfortunately for you, the audience understands the decline question. I'm going to ask you something similar. Do you know why the FBI would meet with Joe Tacopina to share evidence with him?
You know, I don't know why they would share evidence with anybody. As far as my knowledge, however limited it may be with the FBI, my impression, rather than knowledge, is that they take in information. They don't, you know, put it out until they're ready to end the case.
Tacopina said they did.
Right.
And it was one of
Tacopina
those.
Tacopina also said that she didn't take a lie detector. And Deborah Bradley claimed that she did back in November when she was doing the TV shows. And I don't know how you can confuse whether or not you took a lie detector.
No, when he speaks, when he is being deceptive, he will give you the linguistic indicators. When he spoke about...
He must have a field day with this guy, Peter.
That's why I do have a certain respect for him. For the craft that he does in terms of deception. I like to read Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi, the mastermind behind the Nazis, because he was so good at changing words and changing imagery to deceive. It was really quite amazing. He would actually change arguments by changing the words. And this is exactly the method that Joe Tacopina uses. And he's very forceful. Like he said to someone, I don't know if it was Dr. Phil or whatever, just imagine with me for a moment that this woman is innocent. And then he goes off into a tangent. And I think it's deliberate. He left the listeners with the thought that she was innocent and that they should be feeling sorry for her. But he never completed his thought.
Yeah, he's probably a good closer in the courtroom.
I think so, because I think he can prey on the simple-minded. Because to follow him, it does take a little exercise of the mind. It's not easy. When he spoke about meeting with the FBI, I concluded he was telling the truth. And I, for the life of me, I couldn't even picture why they would meet with him other than to negotiate interviewing, which I think did not work out anyway. But in looking back, we don't have any arrests. We have nothing on the horizon. The body decomposition would be extreme. It would not have been preserved. And I can't help but wonder, unless it's just this long wait where the people would wait for Jeremy Irwin and Deborah Bradley to split up and then eventually something come out where it leaks out, it feels like a cold case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Guys.
You know, interesting, real quick, I'll just say it. I met John Paserno, the local attorney working with Tacopina. I met him for the first time today, just as kind of a sidebar. My office is five blocks from the courthouse. Paternos is three blocks. He was walking one direction today across the street, and I was walking the other. And I kind of gave him a double take because he had a nice tan from the summer. And he looked back my direction and gave a double take. And I hollered across the street, and I said, John, yeah? John Paterno, yeah? And I walked across the street. We had a nice, friendly conversation and met for the first time today in passing.
Hmm.
We lose signal?
No, I'm here.
I know we're
I'm
up
with sorry.
This hard hour there.
Yeah, you kind of cut out.
Yeah, well, that was my story.
Peter, are you there?
Yes, I thought you were going to close.
Well, we're running over time. But you can hear the entire show, no matter over time or not, in the archives. So please finish your thoughts. We had Jens. I wanted to add. It's up to you guys. Questions, wrap things up. We've got about 30 minutes where people can hear the entirety of the entire show. So, what do you say?
How about some closing thoughts from all three of us?
Let me go first. Let me go first because
I have to
get these. Oh, thank you. These letters, these followers, so devoted. They are so smart, and they know it here. And Hobnob asks to know why they have not arrested her. Sorry, but for child neglect, at least. Since her neglect led to harm. Any thoughts briefly on that?
You want to take it, Ron?
Yeah, I think that probably in the early part of this case, they didn't pursue anything regarding child neglect because they wanted to get something bigger and better. And then I think this doggone thing has dragged out so long that now it would make them look silly to do it.
I agree with that. I think that if they get desperate enough, maybe they will try to go after, because we've seen it now in other states where they were not able to prove that someone kidnapped their child, but they've been hopefully a new trend coming where even lesser sentences will be given out for child endangerment, false imprisonment, making a false report, other charges, attendant charges. What concerned me on this case was it looked like everything was coming together. Takapina said, stepped up, and when he entered, the flow of information slowed down greatly. The more the information slowed down, the more bravado we heard from the press conferences with the investigative police, especially the spokesman. He got real machismo on camera, and I said to my wife, Heather, uh-oh, that case must be getting worse for them because he's ramping up the rhetoric, and that usually means they're trying to scare Bradley. And I think that probably when Joe Takapina heard him go before the cameras and deepen his voice and sound real confident, they were probably popping the champagne and saying, hey, we got this one down here.
Yeah. Quick thing, let me find it here. Because we've got, you know, Heim, let's see here. I think it's Hobnob who said, we exception when we see it in their statements, only a court can assign guilt. This is why it is called statement in notice. I just wanted to get there. And you guys, why don't you get away?
You're cutting out on me. What was the quote there?
It was Hobnob had said, we assign decision when we see it in their statements, but only it can assign guilt. That's why
yes.
We call it statement analysis.
Yes, it, you know, like behavioral analysis. like evidential review, it is just a tool that points us. I sometimes am guilty of speaking with such certainty because I feel that passionate about it, and Ron took me up on the offer to, that if Baby Lisa was alive, I would not only apologize from West Coast to East Coast, but shut down my blog and run over the computer with a car or something. But that's how convinced I am of the accuracy of statement analysis, especially when someone talks as much as Deborah Bradley talked. She made it really easy for us. But she's correct. It is just a tool that should be used by investigators to bear left, bear right, turn here, turn there, that sort of thing, to guide them. It's like a polygraph. If someone fails a polygraph and they know this person is being deceptive, they still must prove it in a court of law, and that's a different story.
Right. And Ron, I want to thank you again for joining us tonight. Please give us your final thoughts.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of people over the last several months that have asked me what I thought happened in this case. And, you know, we don't know the exact details for sure. I really believe that, and this is just a guess on my part, but there may have been an accident that night, an accident that turned into a big situation that really didn't need to happen, and now it's just gotten out of control. You know, one person that we didn't mention tonight, but mentioned in this case, was Jersey, the handyman from the area of the neighborhood, and I really believe that while he may not have had any direct activity in this case, I think somehow or another he might know something off a branch of it. I don't know. But I've told reporters before that if you look, he was incarcerated for an unrelated crime. And I've told reporters before, and I haven't heard anything about this, that if they will go and look and see what his sentence was for the crime that he was incarcerated for, something to do with a motor vehicle, and compare that with what he could have got, they might find that maybe he made some sort of plea agreement in exchange for information of what he may have seen or known or something that night.
Excellent. And before I close the show, let me give you the last word.
I agree with Ron. I think that the death was inadvertent. I don't think it was intentional. It could have come from neglect, from drinking and dropping her. I think that she died in the bedroom. Given the fact that Deborah seems to have a dark side to her personality, that she's very selfish and immature, my years of child abuse investigation tells me that she might have had her adult time interrupted, lost her temper, did not intend to harm the child, but did, and then went into a panic cover-up mode. At 10 months, it doesn't take a lot. Just a quick moment to shake the baby to silence her from crying, it does work. And then a moment or two later, they see a little bit of gray matter coming out of the ears. The saying is, put the baby down. The babies are going to die. And I've seen babies, what they look like when they've been shaken to death, and it's a terrible thing to see. I think that's probably what happened to Baby Lisa. And then she called in people to help, and the silly phone stories of how they stole her phones, that sort of thing. Someone helped her along the way. So someone does know something besides Deborah. Her 15 minutes of fame are
they
over.
They always do.
Yeah. None of us can keep quiet about everything in life. We're all the same human beings. We all have a need to talk. But her 15 minutes of fame are over. Tacopina tried to resurrect it in the spring with the silly, quote-unquote, breaking news. That was nothing. And I don't think he has much interest left now. So I'm hoping the way Hobnob does is that maybe that they will take a different strategy and try to pin a different arrest on her. We'll see.
I hope we'll see. And, you know, with what you just said, of three people, the secret said. And we know that someone out there that knows the truth. And closing tonight, I want to thank you, Peter, for co-hosting me with me again. Ron Rugen, private investigator, Great Surrey, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I appreciate it. You guys are great.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Remember, we at Your Voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.frontsite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, and good night. Kim Colton signing off with Peter and Ron, and thank you so much. Good night.